In February of 2003, U.S. President George W. Bush, through his Secretary of State Colin Powell, presented what they would have the U.N. Security Council and the world believe was definitive evidence of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction capacity. Was this just an intelligence error or a deliberate deception? 10 years later, how culpable are the governments of both Bush and Obama in war crimes and other violations of international law? And what is the responsibility of U.S. and Canadian governments as far as asserting the right of soldiers to not be forced to fight in conflicts which violate their conscience? We'll hear from legal scholar Francis Boyle and U.S.-Iraq war deserter and author Joshua Key on this 10-year anniversary of the lead-up to the Iraq War. On today's program, America's War, 10 years after Colin Powell. Giving you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 7th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. The leader of Tunisian opposition party, the Unified Democratic Nationalist Party, was shot Wednesday outside his home in Tunis and died in hospital shortly afterward. Chokri Elaid had been an outspoken critic of the Islamist-led government, which had led the nation since the post-Arab Spring election of 2011. His small party had co-founded a leftist alliance known as the Popular Front, which would have contested this year's elections. The tragedy sparked a 1,000-strong protest outside the country's interior ministry, with demonstrators shouting, "Shame, shame, Chokri died. Where is the government?" and "The government should fall." The murder comes in the midst of reports of intimidation of opposition groups in the country, and while a commission of inquiry into an attack against a December trade union rally is set to release its findings in days. And that comes to us from the UK Guardian. Americans learned this week that the White House has developed a mechanism for lawfully targeting and killing Americans with drones, and that the CIA has been using a secret airbase in Saudi Arabia to launch drone attacks against neighboring Yemen. One such drone attack killed U.S. cleric Anwar al-Awlaki and his son in September 2011. The embarrassing revelations came from U.S. media reports coming in the wake of a leaked administration memo. For 12 months, the White House had apparently put pressure on news outlets like the Washington Post to conceal this information in the name of national security. Adding to the concern about the drone base, the sensitivity within the region about the use of Saudi Arabia as a site for U.S. military bases. It was the continued presence of U.S. troops there after the 1991 Gulf War that supposedly provoked the 9/11 attacks, as well as the bombing of the Khobar Towers 5 years later. All U.S. military bases were thought to have been removed following the 2003 invasion of Iraq. John Brennan is the architect of Obama's drone policy and his pick for head of the CIA. Senators were expected to grill Brennan during his confirmation hearing Thursday, as well as press the White House for more details about the legal basis for its drone assassination campaign and the broader policy of allowing the president to sign off on a kill list of known targets. And that comes to us from the UK Guardian. The number of U.S. military veterans who take their own lives stands at 22 and are on the increase, so says a recent study from the Department of Veterans Affairs. The study's findings stated, quote, "A majority of veteran suicides are among those aged 50 years and older. Male veterans who die by suicide are older than non-veteran males who die by suicide, and the age of distribution of veteran and non-veteran women who have died from suicide is similar." According to Robert Bossart, the epidemiologist and researcher who helmed the study. The study conducted over the course of 2 years suggests there is no veterans suicide epidemic, only that veterans are part of a larger national problem. That comes to us from the CBS DC. It was 10 years ago this week, on February 5th, 2003, that then Secretary of State Colin Powell, at the request of President George W. Bush, gave what was billed as definitive evidence, which led the world to believe that the Iraq government was a clear and present threat to the United States and the Western world. Since then, while all of the administration officials acknowledge that there were mistakes, none seem willing to accept that there was deliberate malfeasance or a deliberate deception of the American people. On the line with us right now is Francis Boyle. He is an international law and human rights expert, professor of law at the University of Illinois. He lectures and writes extensively and has authored many books, including Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law, and Biowarfare and Terrorism. He's been a harsh critic of both the Obama and Bush administrations. He's joining us now by phone to elaborate on this 10-year milestone and the significance of the case of the Iraq war invasion. So thank you very much for joining us, Professor Boyle.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and my best to your listening audience. The Powell presentation at the Security Council was a joke and a fraud, and everyone knew it, even at the time, certainly here in the United States. I remember in October of 2002, before the Powell propaganda, I had a debate with a top honcho Republican Party here lawyer here, David Rifkin, live on Pacifica Radio Network, where I said there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and I went through both the reports by the UNSCOM inspectors and the UNMOVIC inspectors, the IAEA, and everything else. So that was all a matter of public record if you were following it carefully. So Rifkin said to me, so do you mean, Professor Boyle, that the president is lying, the vice president is lying, the secretary of state is lying, the secretary of defense is lying, the director of the CIA is lying, and the national security advisor to the president is lying, they're all lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And I said, yes, we went through this exact same set of lies on Vietnam. 58,000 men of my generation were killed. 3 million Vietnamese were exterminated. And a generation later, Secretary of Defense for Johnson, Bob McNamara, and Kennedy comes out in his memoirs in retrospect, saying that, yes, he lied on behalf of the president. These were all lies. Everyone knew it at the time. Powell knew it. Right now, Powell's just shedding some imperial crocodile tears over his report. Powell aided and abetted a Nuremberg crime against peace, against Iraq, for which we unanimously convicted Bush and Blair at the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. The two of them are international criminals, Bush, Blair, and I would say Powell, too, for aiding and abetting. And they should be apprehended and prosecuted by any state that gets a hold of the three of them.
Yes, and it's interesting because the major media, they held at the time, Mr. Powell, and I suppose continue to hold these individuals in high reverence and seem to be just allowing that meme of, well, it was sort of a mistake to continue. So is there maybe the mainstream media?
This is a joke, too, in that it's well known that when he was a major in Vietnam in the Army, Powell helped cover up the My Lai massacre. So there's nothing, I mean, this guy was a bootlicker from the beginning, which is how he got his position. I think he went to work for Al Haig and then bootlicked his way up the bureaucracy there. So he's been a sycophant and a bootlicker and now a war criminal. So I don't know what else to say, but I think everyone who tried to stop that war knew full well, right from the beginning, from the get-go, there were no weapons of mass destruction. And the IAEA reports and the UNMAVIC reports and the UNSCOM reports prove it.
So what
they had access to, they had access, Powell had access to the exact same documents I did.
Hmm.
And Powell, Bush, Blair, they all lied. And everyone knew at the time they were lying. And I said as early as mid-October 2002 publicly on Pacifica Radio Network Live, they were all lying. But I wasn't the only one.
And another, the whole idea of the weapons inspectors at that time is like September, October, and you know, I remember hearing President Bush, I'm going to give Saddam Hussein one last chance to comply, and that whole business about sending the weapons inspectors, was that also a deception as far as we the evidence can tell? Or
sure, report by Hans Blix, the last one he sent in there to the Security Council, made it clear they hadn't found any weapons of mass destruction. They just weren't there. So that, too, was part of the charade. Indeed, it was Clinton who pulled out, ordered the U.N. weapons inspectors under Butler to get out prior to his bombing of Iraq in Operation Desert Storm, in an unsuccessful effort to stave off impeachment by the U.S. House of Representatives. And the moment he was impeached, he stopped the bombing. So, you know, there are just so many lies, propaganda, deceptions. It's hard to go through them all. If you have a look at my book, Destroying World Order, that takes the story up to the outbreak of the Bush Jr., Blair, war against Iraq in 2003. And then I continue the story in my book, Breaking All the Rules, and then Tackling America's Toughest Questions. So, you know, the footnotes are there. You can read it for yourself. Professor Chomsky has said pretty much the same thing I've said if you go through any of his writings.
Mm. Now, in terms of aiding and abetting this war crime, where does the mainstream media fit in? Would you say they should be held accountable as well?
Well, of course they're accountable. There's no question at all. I mean, this goes back to the classic work by Herman and Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent, where they did a detailed content analysis of the U.S. media's coverage of the Vietnam War and concluded that the U.S. media fully supported the Vietnam War and served nothing more than a conveyor belt for U.S. governmental propaganda in support of the Vietnam War. And they applied the propaganda model by Bernays, which you can have a look at. So nothing has changed, certainly, in the last 50 years or more of my political life when it comes to the mainstream U.S. News media. Nothing at all.
In terms of proper procedure, though, I mean, what should, I mean, in an ideal world, I mean, we should be seeing, I presume you would argue that the impeachment, if not the, and certainly the arrest of the people responsible. So, what would, should have taken place to all these players, should have happened to all these players, including the media?
Well, it's harder to get the media. As I said, I've gotten Bush and Blair convicted for Nuremberg crimes against peace, and we are trying to track them down and get them prosecuted for that, yes, around the world. And we have a committee set up for that purpose. And I know your colleague, Michel Chossudovsky, played a very important role in these efforts, to his great credit. As for the media figures, yeah, you just can't. It legally, it's hard to indict the media in general. You have to go after specific figures. We do have some precedent at Nuremberg, for example, Rosenberg inciting hatred against the Jews, and there was another media figure, and also now at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Some media figures have been convicted for inciting genocide. So there is some precedent for indicting media figures. I would, you know, come to mind certainly Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity here in the United States are two of the worst. But again, I'm kind of busy doing other things right now. But maybe, actually, I did have a student do a paper on accountability of media for inciting international crimes. So there have been a handful of convictions, and the ICTR convictions are relatively new. So in theory, it can be done, but... You know, we've got all sorts of wars going on right now, and I'm doing my best. You know, Syria, Libya, Mali, the Palestinians, Afghanistan, whatever. And I'm working full time against all these things, and you know, going after the media people, I regret to say, just cannot be very high on my list.
Okay, now having made that. Case for war, however fraudulent, it was waged without a UN Security Council resolution making it a violation of the UN Charter. But the UN did allow, by the end of 2003, it did affirm the right of U.S. troops to continue their operations in Iraq. So where do you see the UN in terms of their role in this whole situation?
Yes, well, technically, I do analyze those UN resolutions in the three books I mentioned to you, as well as another book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, by Rauman and Littlefield. Basically, what the UN did was just accept the fact that U.S. and British military forces occupied Iraq and determined that in the course of that occupation, they were bound to obey the four Geneva Conventions of 1949 and the Hague Regulations of 1907. As we know, the United States and Britain paid absolutely no attention at all to the four Geneva Conventions of 1949 and the Hague Regulations of 1907. Today, the UN certainly has become, I won't say the General Assembly, but certainly the... Secretariat, Secretary General, Assistant Secretaries General, etc., are nothing more than rubber stamps for the United States, first and foremost, and to a lesser extent, Britain and France. Look at the shameless role the UN bureaucracy and the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon played both against Libya and now against Syria. So... you know, the UN has gone the same way that the League of Nations did in the late 1930s when it was subject to the depredations of Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan. It's nothing more than a front organization for U.S.-NATO criminality around the world.
Hmm. Now, do you want to maybe just mention a couple of the what you see as the more egregious breaches of those Geneva and Hague conventions that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I have them all in my books. The shock and awe, depleted uranium, Fallujah, which is a Nuremberg war crime. If you read the Nuremberg Charter, It says quite clearly that the wanton devastation of cities, towns, and villages is a Nuremberg war crime along the lines of what the Nazis did. That's there. Depleted uranium, Fallujah, shock and awe. There are massacres, you name it, they did it. So, the best estimate is just during the course of that war alone, 1.4 million Iraqis were killed. And then before the war, maybe 1.8 million Iraqis were exterminated by means of the genocidal sanctions imposed by the United States, starting with the Bush senior administration in August of 1990 until they were removed in June of 2003. So I do have a paper on global research you can look at, and I estimate, at a minimum, the United States government exterminated 3.3 million Iraqis from August of 1990 until Obama finally pulled the U.S. out at the end of last year. And that's a fairly conservative estimate. Professor Polya has given a higher figure of maybe 4.7 million. So somewhere in there is what we're talking about. Clearly, genocide.
Can I ask you if your thoughts about the role of Canada in terms of the Iraq war crimes? Because while they got a lot of attention for not officially supporting George Bush's coalition of the willing, we did have soldiers in Afghanistan working in tandem with the United States and relieving soldiers there to fight in Iraq. Do you have any other thoughts about, to what extent Canada should be sanctioned?
Well, to its credit, the Canadian government did stay out of the Iraq slaughter by Bush and Blair, and I think it should be commended for that. It did have a ship or some ships, I think, in the Persian Gulf that were part of the naval interdiction. As for what Canada has done in Afghanistan, that's a separate legal issue that I do address at greater length in my book, Tackling America's Toughest Questions, not specifically Canada's behavior, although I do mention Canada, I think, in there, but the illegality and criminality of the war against Afghanistan that still, by the way, continues today as we speak, and will continue at least till 2014, if not beyond. There's no real end in sight.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the responsibility of the individual soldiers themselves? I know that a number of them have abandoned the Iraq War, recognizing that this is the wrong thing to do. Some of them have come to Canada to seek sanctuary, and the administration of Stephen Harper is essentially branding them as criminals because they are deserting the military, and desertion is considered a criminal offense. And so there have already been a few of these resistors sent back to the United States as a result. Do you have any thoughts about what Canada's legal responsibility is with regard to Iraq War deserters who seek sanctuary in Canada rather than go to fight and serve in what they come to see as an illegal and immoral war?
Yes, it's very unfortunate what Mr. Harper has done up there. As you know, during the Vietnam War, Canada kindly gave asylum to all the men of my generation who fled the criminal Vietnam War. And Mr. Harper, as you know, is a soulmate of President Bush, who started the war, and is returning these courageous individuals back to the United States for prosecution. I helped in the defense of the first Gulf War resistor, Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia, and also the highest ranking officer to refuse to go to Iraq, Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara. These cases are explained in great detail in my book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, which is why I wrote this book, to explain to other lawyers how to defend these heroes. There's no question all about it. Men who have decided that as a matter of good faith and conscience, they could not serve in a criminal war and commit war crimes. And that, you know, I go through the basis for that in my book. In the case of Staff Sergeant Mejia, the first resistor, he got a kangaroo court proceeding, Stalinist show trial by the Pentagon down at Fort Lewis, Georgia. I was down there for this. At the end, and was stripped of all of his witnesses except me. And at the end of the day, he got, I believe it was 8 months. He was facing 2 years. He shouldn't have faced anything because it was a conscientious objector. And in the United States, you have a constitutional right of conscientious objection at any time, even in an all-volunteer military force, as determined by the United States Supreme Court. I spent time with Staff Sergeant Mejia. He's a very courageous, principled man. Got the 8 months. We immediately got him adopted a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International, just along the lines of Sakharov or Havel or Aung San Suu Kyi or any of these other human rights heroes that the United States praises around the world, but not when it comes to our own people. As for Lieutenant Ouattara, yes, he was facing 5 or 6 different charges, 11 years, and we got a mistrial because the Pentagon was afraid of going to trial, because if they did with their case and our evidence, there's a very high likelihood that Lieutenant Ouattara would have been acquitted on the grounds that he refused to serve in a criminal war against Iraq and refused to commit war crimes. So he was out, and no penalty. I mean, I believe he probably took some, you know, administrative discharge, but no time spent in prison. And in Lieutenant Ouattara's case, for the first time ever, we got Amnesty International to designate him as an anticipatory prisoner of conscience, namely that if he were convicted and incarcerated after the end of this kangaroo court and Stalinist show trial, Amnesty International was going to adopt him as a prisoner of conscience. But fortunately, it never came to that. If you are interested in these cases and how we've successfully defended them here in the United States, and you can read my book, Protesting Power, and the principles here are directly relevant to the GI resistors up in Canada who fled this criminal war in the United States, and I would hope their Canadian lawyers could get a hold of this book and try to apply some of those same principles and keep them in Canada instead of being sent back here for persecution.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partner radio stations across the country. We're also podcast at the website for the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. It is believed that the rise of the Democrats and Barack Obama to the U.S. presidency was secured in large part due to the unpopularity of the Iraq War, which became one of the hallmarks of the Bush Republicans. Now with Obama in power for 4 more years, questions have arisen about how much of an improvement he has been over Bush in terms of upholding the law and civil liberties. As a controversial memo has recently been leaked outlining the circumstances under which the drone assassination of U.S. citizens believed to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda might be legal, we asked Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois to compare the two presidents.
Right. Well, first, before we get to the drone memo, President Obama and the Obama people are basically accessories after the fact to all the Bush crimes against and in Iraq. They've covered it up, and they've refused to prosecute anyone for any of these crimes, despite having a legal obligation under United States domestic law and treaties and international law to prosecute them. So that technically makes them accessories after the fact to all the crimes against Iraq. As for the drone memo, yes, to put Obama into context, even President Bush Jr. himself, now a convicted war criminal, never arrogated to himself the alleged power to murder United States citizens. So Obama is worse than Bush. Second, Obama waged this clearly illegal, genocidal, and unconstitutional war of aggression against Libya in 2011 without any authorization from the United States Congress. Well, again, even President Bush Jr., in his wars against Afghanistan and Iraq, did get authorization from the United States Congress, I think mistakenly so, to wage those wars. So, again, on Libya, President Obama is also worse than President Bush Jr. So you have two counts here. Both foreign and domestic. Third, the National Defense Authorization Act permits the U.S. military effectively to pick up anyone here in the United States, including U.S. citizens, and to detain them and remove them, and arguably to subject them to extraordinary rendition to another country, where they could be tortured, move them down to Gitmo, or disappeared. And in the legislation produced by Congress for the NDAA, according to Senator Levin, it was President Obama's idea and demand that the NDAA apply to United States citizens here in the United States of America. Now, that makes him just as bad as Bush, because Bush did that to people here in the United States. On the other two counts, he's worse. So I think that gives you a pretty good idea of Obama, to some extent, is even worse with Bush. As for the drone memo, which I have read, studied quite carefully yesterday, you have to understand, of course, this drone memo is a summary of the opinions produced by the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice. It was written by Professor Barron at Harvard Law School and Professor Letterman at Georgetown Law School, authorizing the murder of the United States citizens. Well, certainly you don't want to go study at Harvard Law School and Georgetown Law School with professors who have purported to authorize the murder of United States citizens in violation of numerous statutes and treaties to which the United States government is a party, and international criminal law. If you read through the memo, which is based on the opinion, it's the same thing the Bush torture lawyers did. And by the way, at the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal last fall, in November of 2012, we got Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Tenet, and their lawyers convicted for torture and war crimes. And the whole purpose of these Bush torture memos produced by the same Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice which sort of reminds me of the Nazi Ministry of Justice. Indeed, the Nazi Ministry of Justice produced similar memoranda, and some of those lawyers were prosecuted. They did it for the reason that they wanted to concoct a defense for Bush and all the rest of them on torture, and the defense would be advice of counsel. Well, I was just doing what my lawyers told me that I could do, and therefore I did not have criminal intent. Now, we successfully destroyed that legalistic pedophaging at the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal in November. I think Professor Chasudowski has materials on that on the Global Research website. Did not accept any of these arguments, and in fact, these lawyers were simply part of a criminal conspiracy, along with Bush, Cheney, and the rest of them, to commit torture and war crimes. It's the exact same thing on this drone memo. If you read through it, you can't take any of it seriously. In effect, what is happening here is that the Office of Legal Counsel, the Nazi Ministry of Justice, and Professor Barron and Letterman are attempting to concoct a defense for Obama and Brennan and the CIA and the people at the Department of Defense running the drone campaigns. There are two of them, a CIA campaign and a Pentagon campaign, of advice of counsel, and basically saying, well, our lawyers told us we could do it, and therefore we did not have criminal intent, so we could murder United States citizens to our heart's content, as well as now approximately 5,000 Muslims, as best as, you know, objective evidence has been able to figure out. Well, it's clear if you read the memo, they're very worried about the U.S. federal statute that expressly prohibits anyone here in the United States from murdering a U.S. citizen abroad. They're very worried about that, and, you know, did their best to cobble together whatever they could. They know they are vulnerable, certainly on that statute, and the then if that statute also would be the U.S. War Crimes Act, and I won't even get into the International Criminal Court statute. Well, I will. Actually, if you read the ICC statute, the drone strikes are war crimes for sure. And when you have war crimes that are widespread or systematic, they become crimes against humanity. And that's clearly what is going on here. You have widespread and systematic drone campaigns by Obama, Brennan, heads of the CIA and the Special Operations Command in the Pentagon, and they are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And finally, if you read Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, I think it's pretty clear that Obama has become a genocidaire. We know for a fact that on Tuesday mornings, Obama personally selects everyone to be murdered by drones and designates them to be murdered. We also know that there have been about 5,000 Muslims all over the world murdered by Obama. Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, which, by the way, the United States government is a party to, and we have domestic implementing legislation making genocide a crime, says, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such, killing members of the group. Well, notice the language here, religious group, i.e. Muslims. To the best of my knowledge, all the victims of the drone strikes have been Muslims around the world. And it also says in whole or in part. In part, I would say 5,000 is certainly enough to qualify. The World Court in the Bosnia case ruled that the extermination of 7,500 Bosnian Muslims at Srebrenica was genocide. So I think, you know, 5,000 dead Muslims by Obama would qualify as genocide, too.
These are...
So those are the, you know, the legal issues as I see them today, as, you know, as we speak. Bringing the rule of law to bear on Obama and the rest of them will be just as difficult as it has been to bring the rule of law to bear against Bush. And here I note the very courageous work up in Canada done by Gail Davidson, my colleague up there.
Lawyers Against the War.
The War. Yeah. We have three times tried to get Bush prosecuted in Canada. One time, I think one time, tried to get Cheney, but he chickened out. And I really don't know if Bush is going to go back to Canada. And it's really Gail who has done the work, you know, the laboring work on that, and I've assisted her to the extent I can. I also scared Bush out of Switzerland. He was afraid of getting prosecuted for torture there. There are no statute of limitations for the commission of these international crimes. And so Bush and Blair and Obama can be prosecuted for these crimes for the rest of their lives and by any state that wants to prosecute them. These are universal jurisdiction crimes. So, you know, it's really up to you, the listening audience, to what extent we will be able to get these people put in jail. But I want to say, you know, there's literally an army of lawyers out there trying to track these people down and put them in jail. I'm confident certainly the Bush people we're going to get. And Obama, I guess once he's out of office, you know, we'll go after him. It's very hard because of head of state immunity to get someone actually in office, a president in office. But once he's out of office, he's fair game for prosecution. And in the case of Obama, unlike Bush, Bush was not a lawyer. And so I guess, you know, he could say, well, my lawyers told me I could do it, sort of like the devil made me do it. In the case of Obama, he was after me at Harvard Law School. He's a lawyer, and he taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago Law School, where I went as an undergrad. So Obama knows better, certainly, than Bush, and he's worse than Bush. And so he's not even going to be able to prevail, I think, on any type of advice of counsel defense for any of his international crimes.
Professor Boyle, your portrayal of these high officials as international renegades is certainly uncommon in the mainstream media, but we do very much appreciate your bringing them to our program. I want to thank you for bringing that expert viewpoint to the Global Research News Hour. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I wish to say bonjour to all my French relatives, Monarque, up in Montreal.
Okay. Bonjour et à bientôt. That was Professor Francis Boyle, international law and human rights expert and professor of law at the University of Illinois. As he states in his 2007 memoir, The Deserter's Tale, the story of an ordinary soldier who walked away from the war in Iraq, U.S. Private First Class Joshua Key believed the reasons given by the Bush administration for going to war in Iraq to protect America from terrorists and bring freedom to the Iraqi people. His experiences there dramatically changed his perspectives on the conflict, and in December of 2003, after serving Iraq almost from the start of the Iraq invasion, Joshua deserted the U.S. Army. After traveling through the U.S. with his wife, then wife and children for about a year, evading military police along the way, he finally crossed the border into Canada and has sought sanctuary rather than return to the U.S. where he would, he believes, likely face punishment for desertion. Joshua Key now joins us from his home in the province of Saskatchewan to share with us his thoughts on and experiences with regard to the Iraq War. So thank you for joining us, Joshua Key.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
So do you want to maybe just to sort of briefly outline some of the experiences you had in Iraq that caused you to change your perspectives on what that war was all about?
Well, I'll leave it short. I mean, I think everyone has their own ideal of what war is. My time in the war, especially at the beginning, was very bloody, very... you know, like it's, I always try to put it in a nutshell of chaos, destruction, and civilian deaths, friends getting maimed. I mean, it was a whole, it was scary in itself. I look back now, you know, being pretty well 10 years, it's quite remarkable that it's been 10 years ago, but yet in my mind it seems like it was yesterday. Many things that, you know, for what I consider and what the courts tell me, you know, many, you know, crimes against humanity and war crimes. And I myself witnessed and participated in many things that fall upon them lines. It's very disturbing and very, you know, destructive, especially to a person's soul as well as mine. That's a suffer with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I would say that's many, many, many of us do, thousands.
Mm. And, yeah, there have been many you know, casualties of that war, people who have committed suicides as well, right?
The suicide rate's going out the door, out the window. I mean, it's, you know, for veterans from the war on terror from Afghanistan and Iraq, as many as 30 soldiers a month commit suicide, and that's veterans, and active duty as well. I mean, it's a number they don't talk about much. It's been coming out more lately because it's such a problem, and it's something that they're going to have to address. It's completely it's crazy to think that already that many people have been taking their own lives because of what we all did and participated in war.
Mm. Now, you crossed into Canada in 2005 and sought to seek sanctuary here and not have to go back to the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about how that process unrolled?
It's been one hell of a roller coaster. I mean, it's when I first came here in 2005, it was the Liberal government. Things looked very much different at the time I came here. It sort of had a decent amount of hope. Through the years, of course, as everyone knows, with the Harper government, I mean, you know, things haven't diminished by any means, but things have really been a roller coaster. Like, I've been to the immigration court many times. I'll win one, lose one, and then it sort of goes with all of us like that. All of us will lose, 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 and then we'll have one win. And I mean, there's I think around 30 of us here that are doing the same thing, which I am, which is you know in the process of trying to stay in Canada legally and fight the system. But it has been very, very hard. I mean, there's only a few groups of people that the government has pretty well deemed bogus refugee claimants, and I mean in a personal manner, and that's been I guess the Roma Gypsies is one, and the others has been the war resisters, and this became a very hard battle. I mean, you know, they've put out bulletin, news bulletin 202, where the government stated that no immigration officials along the whole board, regardless, are not allowed to grant us any status. So it's made it where we're all here, we're all within the system, but yet we're not allowed to work, we don't get health care. I laugh many times because as we're hearing the radio and watching the news, you know, the Minister of Immigration, Mr. Kenney, makes it seem like that all these refugee applicants come here, we live off the system, and we're just, you know, running everything up. And I think that's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard in my life.
That sounds quite different from what we've heard about the Vietnam War, when very much parallel to the Iraq War, people who could not stomach the idea of going to Vietnam for moral and legal reasons. They came up to Canada and were allowed to stay here. But your experience has obviously been quite different, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, of course, everyone says, you know, that it was and sometimes it was the draft, and yes, it was. I mean, and that was the big difference from now. But in other words, though, people don't understand of the poverty draft. I mean, when you're looking at nothing, you have no future, and there is nothing. Like I've said, you know, at that time I was married to my ex-wife. I had three children. There was no future. There was nothing. I mean, it's either, you know, you go work at McDonald's and make nothing, or, you know, and then you go to a recruiter and they make it sound like you're joining the most best establishment in the world. Oh, you won't have to go to war, you won't have to do this, you won't have to do that. And at that time, you know, Afghanistan was going on, but in the military's eyes, as well as most of my time within the military, it was a joke. They didn't see Afghanistan as a war. It was more of, at that time, a peacekeeping mission. It was a complete joke as far as we were concerned at that time. You know, Iraq hadn't started. It was... it didn't, you know, for what I was being told of what I would be offered, I thought, you know, why wouldn't a person? I mean, to make a life for yourself, to actually be able to sustain, have steady work. I wasn't in there for the college money. I mean, that wasn't it wasn't my deal. My deal was that I wanted steady work and health care for my family.
Hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, here you are in Canada. And you're not really all that well off. I mean, you're still struggling to make ends meet, correct?
Oh, at every given corner, yes. I mean, it's I'm not allowed to work legally. It's a give or take. I mean, you know, they don't allow you to work. They don't allow you to have health care. Me and my wife, who is Canadian, we are in the sponsorship.
This is
process.
A second wife, correct?
Yes. We're in the sponsorship process, but still, even within that process, you can't, nor would we, but you don't get no government help in any form. So you have to provide for yourselves, and you have to do for yourselves, which makes it very difficult, just in the sense that I myself, from being a younger, I'm a skilled welder. I know that I could be making quite good money within Canada right now in many different places. But without having the ability to allow it to work, You can't produce nothing. Mm. And also the healthcare situation. Like I go to an emergency room. Most people don't understand this. I go to an emergency room. They don't take me in and do what needs to be done. They look at me and say, "Where I got to have $500 before I can even let you go in the back." Mm. And it's when you don't have any money, that means you ain't going to the emergency room. I see how good that is for my wife and my children here. I mean, because that's an awesome system to where they get whatever they need covered. They walk into an emergency room, they get seen. It's quite different for myself, but it goes to all the refugees and all the people applying for refugee status in Canada. With the changes that's been made to the IFH, the Interim Federal Health, it's very damning to what it has did to all. And I worry about all people of that are within the processes of... The health of everyone, because it's when they did that and they took that away, I mean, that put a very much a and also, you know, another, I guess, thing that the Harper government stated that was going to save, you know, taxpayers so much money. When it boiled down to it, it saved the individual taxpayers 3 cents. Mm-hmm. To keep you know, these refugee applicants,
yeah,
with the at least the essential health care that they needed. So
yeah, and that's not just people who are U.S. vets, like refugees across the board.
Exactly, that's all the way across the board.
Okay, now I know that you authored a book, The Deserter's Tale, and that's probably where you really rose to prominence. It really was a kind of like a whistleblowing memoir. What have been the impacts of that that book? I mean, beyond getting you a lot of international acclaim, has that helped your cause in any way?
Oh, I would say it does. I would say it continues to. I mean, it. I can never do. Interviews on the radio or television or newspapers, magazines that could ever get my story across like the book has. With it being the availability of it being in so many countries and so many languages, I mean, it's helped the overall picture, and especially of people understanding why I'm in Canada and people like myself are here. Like I tell people, it's not this fantasy of, since you got a book and it's you got a sell and you're making $1 million, because that's about a joke and a half.
It is a bestseller in some countries, is it not?
Yes. Yeah, in Australia it did quite well, and in a few countries in Europe it did. But it's still like Lawrence Hill, who wrote it for me. Like I laughed because he told me when we started, you ain't gonna see any money unless you sell 1 million copies. And I would have to say Larry was quite right. It's books are not a money making machine anymore. I mean, it's not at all.
Money maker for the publisher, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Money maker for them, I think so. But as far as by the time it trickles down to the individual author, I think you have a better chance of winning the lottery.
Mm-hmm. So, what about have you encountered other obstacles within your family in terms of getting assistance from the government financially?
Well, as far as getting assistance from the government financially, I mean, that doesn't happen.
No.
I mean, it's, it took us years to get a child tax benefit for my Canadian-born children from my Canadian wife. I mean, they withheld that for over a year because of who I was. I mean, they just kept on sort of throwing it around and giving different excuses, and it was completely back and forth. From the help of Olivia Chow is how we got our child tax money back to us.
That's an NDP member of parliament from Toronto, right?
Yes. Other than that, I mean, it's, ever since I came to this country, I've always said it. All I've ever wanted to do is work and live in peace. And that's still all I want. I've been here, this will be going on my 8th year in this country. I guess that'll be as of March. I'll be here for 8 years. And it, I know it'll happen. I mean, it's gonna. I can sure know that the road is not done yet. I mean, there's still a lot of time left and a lot of fighting left, and that's for me and all my fellow soldiers here. And it's a to the ones that have been sent back and who go to prison. I never would have came to this country and did what I have did if I ever would have thought for 1 second I would go back. I mean, you sort of have to look at it. You know the score when you leave. You know the score when you come across that border. Yeah, you're in it for the long haul. I'll always abide by Canadian law, but I will fight till the end because Geneva Conventions, international law, and things that should be accounted and looked at, especially in my case, I will make sure that they're looked at one way or the other, because you can't take people that are legitimate refugee claimants and find a way to get rid of us and act like we don't exist, in the sense not following their own treaties that they signed themselves.
Joshua Key, is there, for listeners who may be interested in assisting you and other resistors and deserters, is there a website or a phone number contact you'd like them to get in touch with?
There's always resistors.ca, which gives a lot of helpful information. And then in Winnipeg and the surrounding area there, there's always, the way I look at it, you can contact my mother-in-law and father-in-law, who always does a lot of things for us when they can, and that's Cheryl Ann and Daryl Rankin, and that's, 204-792-3371.
Okay, well, Joshua Key, thank you very much for sharing these experiences with us, and all the best in the future.
Okay, well, thank you guys for listening.
And I've been speaking with Joshua Key, U.S. Iraq War deserter. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering stations across the country. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.